Abraham Lincoln is at the top of everyone's list of greatest American presidents, but we tend to think of his achievements in domestic terms, freeing the slaves, saving the Union, and winning the Civil War. However, during that conflict, it was imperative for him to maintain and control U.S. relationships with the major European nations. Lincoln was not a natural diplomat. He never traveled overseas, spoke no foreign languages, and yet during the Civil War, he somehow managed to contain the great powers of Europe and prevent any of them from intervening on the side of the Confederacy. As a result, the United States emerged from the conflict as a world power in its own right. Kevin Perino, a veteran foreign correspondent who worked at Newsweek for a decade, tells the story of this achievement in Lincoln in the World. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Perino to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Just when you believe that the presidency of Lincoln has been covered from every possible angle, a new facet of the man emerges. How did you come up with this story?
Well, I was based in the Middle East as a foreign correspondent at the time, and I was reporting from places like Syria and Libya and Yemen, kind of doing on-the-ground, street-level reporting. And I went through this period where I really found myself wanting to step back and look at larger frameworks of American foreign policy, traditions of American foreign policy. And so I started doing reading, started doing research, and this period really sucked me in. I mean, you've got Lincoln's got this, his minister to Russia, Cassius Marcellus Clay, walks around St. Petersburg with Bowie knives dangling from his waistband, and he gets in fistfights on the streets of St. Petersburg. And there's just these wonderful characters in this story, and it was something that hadn't been covered before in detail.
Or that there was a Cassius Clay before there was a Muhammad Ali.
Right, exactly.
Have most historians seen this story as simply a byproduct of his management of the Civil War?
Yes, and I think the real reason that, aside from the fact that the Civil War we think of as a domestic conflict, is Lincoln had a very strong and competent Secretary of State in William Henry Seward.
Although they were constantly at war with each other.
Right, particularly at the beginning of their administration.
I would have thought he would have fired him. We'll get into that in a little while.
Right.
Most presidents wouldn't have put up with some of the things that Seward did.
Right, and I think it's to Lincoln's credit that he kept him around, because Seward in a lot of ways was more worldly than Lincoln. But this is part of the reason I think there hasn't been a holistic human look at Lincoln's foreign affairs in nearly 70 years, is that if you put Lincoln at the center of his own foreign policy, you get a hagiography, because Lincoln did a lot. So what I've tried to do is slice it into the things that Lincoln did do in foreign affairs without saying he did everything.
Now, Lincoln lived in a time when there was a growing information age of another sort. What technologies revolutionized the practice of foreign affairs?
Well, in the years leading up to the Civil War, we see the advent of the telegraph, the steamship. There was a huge boom in newspaper readership. And so, not unlike our own globalizing world, the world was shrinking, and it had important ramifications for diplomacy.
And you say that Lincoln exploited the newspaper culture in the same way that Teddy Roosevelt used what he called his bully pulpit?
Right. Lincoln saw the Emancipation Proclamation partly as an opportunity to speak across the Atlantic to ordinary European mill workers in places like Liverpool and Manchester who were affected by the cotton shortages.
So the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't just aimed at Americans and at the South?
Right. It was partly aimed at Europe. Lincoln believed strongly that it could be a tool to influence Europeans in Britain and France in particular. And you know, during the Civil War, you read the letters coming into Lincoln from his diplomats, and they're constantly telling him, well, if you would just change the goal of the war from Union to anti-slavery, you would have a lot better opportunity of capturing the hearts and minds of some of these people. And Lincoln believed that.
Well, you have to wonder why some of those European countries were even thinking of supporting the Confederacy, considering the fact that they had all earlier decided that slavery was a bad thing.
You're exactly right. I mean, there was a kind of gleefulness on the part of Lord Palmerston, the British Prime Minister, Napoleon III, the French Emperor, as they saw the Union going to pieces. Palmerston liked to talk about the disunited states of America, and after Bull Run, he called it Yankees Run. And they enjoyed seeing this on a kind of visceral level. But you're right in that the real interests of the European powers were probably not to see the United States go to pieces. Britain was the United States' largest creditor at that point, so there were commercial and financial ties. And for France, I mean, Britain was the historical enemy of France during the Napoleonic Wars. So if a united Union was a counterweight to Britain for France.
Well, What was how important was the fact that the United States was emerging as an economic force with a large manufacturing output when the Civil War broke out? Did Europeans feel threatened?
Europeans did feel threatened to some extent, and you're right. The United States was essentially an emerging market in this period. It was the India or the China of its day. It was growing at 4 or 5% a year at this period. So you're right. There was this kind of interesting dynamic where there were things that were holding the relationship together, but also jealousies and animosities that in a crisis could have erupted into a war. And I think that was part of why Lincoln was so successful during this period, is that he kept these crises, any one of which could have erupted into war, from doing so.
Wasn't there a feeling at the time that foreign affairs should be best left to the well-bred, the well-connected, the wisest people who were at least presented themselves differently than Lincoln? Alexis de Tocqueville made an interesting comment about foreign politics and democracy.
Right. Alexis de Tocqueville said that democracies were decidedly inferior when it came to handling foreign affairs. He said they would abandon mature design for a momentary caprice. What Lincoln, I think, showed is that you didn't have to be cosmopolitan to be diplomatic. Lincoln was a natural diplomat. We kind of know that about him. There was a contemporary of his at the time that said his laugh was like the neigh of a wild horse. And so he could get diplomats in a room, tell a story or joke, crack them up. That was a really useful thing in diplomacy.
Well, presidents have had varying degrees of power in forging foreign policy. What was it like during Lincoln's time? How strong was Congress in deciding these matters?
Congress played a role. It's particularly interesting to look at a particular crisis with Mexico. The French invaded Mexico, I think people forget, in 1863. And so there were a lot of people in the penny press, in Congress, even some members of Lincoln's own party, who were urging him to invade and invade Mexico, drive the French out, and even to unite with the Confederate armies and drive the French out. And Lincoln resisted that impulse, a lot of the urging of which was coming from Congress.
But hadn't he earlier opposed the Mexican War, 1846?
Right, and that's one of the interesting things to watch, I think, as Lincoln's worldview unfolds, is that he happened to be in Congress in 1846, and he opposed the origins of the Mexican War. Something I think about the seat of the White House, about being in the White House, changes your view of that matter. So when he had a different seat, I think he changed his view to some extent.
Well, the Mexican War was quite popular. Whether it was fair or unfair is another matter altogether. And it did wind up gaining the United States a big chunk of territory. Did it hurt Lincoln that he was opposed?
It did to some extent. And his law partner at the time kept urging him that he would be committing political suicide by opposing the origins of that war, and it did. It came back to haunt him to some extent. Stephen Douglas used it against him in the late 1850s,
and he lost that.
He lost not because of the Mexican War stance, but it was one aspect of that campaign. But I don't think. That wasn't the deciding issue that made Lincoln leave Congress at that point, his Mexican War stance. But sure, yep, opponents used it against him later in his career.
Seward felt that a war might unite the country.
He did, and it's unclear exactly what Seward was thinking. But at the beginning of the Civil War, in the very early days, April 1st, 1861, Seward urged the United States to declare war on Spain, which had recently re-annexed Santo Domingo in the Caribbean. That was one of the examples of a time when Lincoln restrained Seward. You were talking about that before, and Lincoln said, no, A, we're not going to do that, and B, if we were going to do that, it would be my decision and not your decision. But by the end of Lincoln's presidency, he and Seward had become close. One Seward biographer said they were like each other's sober second thought. It was almost like a husband and wife relationship, where sometimes Lincoln was right, sometimes Seward was right, and together they made pretty good policy.
And what was Seward's official position in the government?
He was Secretary of State.
And it was called Secretary of State at the time?
Yes.
But he would be handling the diplomatic end.
Right. He handled a lot of the day-to-day diplomacy.
And he offered Lincoln a broader perspective?
He He did offer. And you know who else offered Lincoln a broader perspective is his wife, Mary Lincoln. I mean, Mary was more cosmopolitan than Lincoln in a lot of ways. She grew up in Lexington, Kentucky. She went to a boarding school where students spoke French. And she and her family, the Todds, kind of lorded this over Lincoln. Lincoln liked to say that 1D was good enough for God, but not for the Todds. And so she interfered in diplomatic appointments to some extent. And she tangled with Seward.
Yeah, she didn't like Seward. Yeah. Well, after he'd lost that race for the Senate in 1860, what did he think he was going to do?
Well, he was despairing for a while, but he quickly got back into the swing of things, into politics.
He's elected president 2 years later.
He was a lawyer, and he was elected president 2 years later. So,
how did he react when the Southern states seceded?
The beginning of the war has been told in dozens and dozens of books about how he reinforced Fort Sumter with supplies, but not arms. And the Fort Sumter crisis was very important for him in terms of foreign affairs because he knew that the whole world was watching. France was watching, Spain was watching, Europe in general was watching, and he felt like to abandon Fort Sumter completely would send the wrong message to the European powers.
After the Revolutionary War, hadn't the maintenance of independence from Europe been America's primary foreign policy?
It had, and I think one of the things that is overlooked because the issue of slavery sort of overshadows all our thinking about Lincoln. Lincoln was very concerned early on with economic issues, and so were members of the Whig Party, which he was a member of before he was a Republican, and they were very much about creating an American system of reciprocal trade agreements with various countries that would help create this American system that could be a rival to the European system that was existing. At the times.
Although this is at a time when the classic traditions of European diplomacy were also in a state of flux, what had caused an Austrian diplomat to say, the days of principles are gone?
Right. The Crimean War, and this is a really interesting dynamic. I mean, after the Congress of Vienna in the 1815, the European powers had sort of agreed to form alliances to keep a new Napoleon from rising on the continent. So they protected these kind of shared values at the time, which meant protecting aristocratic statesmen. But after the Crimean War in the 1850s, the whole nature of the goals of European states changed, and power itself became the goal in international affairs. This is the age of realpolitik. Otto von Bismarck becomes prime minister in Prussia in 1862. You've got Palmerston in Britain, who says Britain has no eternal friends, only national interests. So we have a lot of really hard-nosed statesmen at work in the international arena during this period.
And then you have Louis Napoleon trying to extend France's reach around the world, including sending was his brother to Mexico?
It wasn't his brother. It was an Austrian archduke who he sent to Mexico to be the figurehead there. And Napoleon was also somewhat hard-headed, but he was not as competent as people like Palmerston in Britain. He tended to overreach and to be kind of buffeted by the winds of the moment, public opinion of the moment.
My guest is Kevin Perano, Peraino. His latest book, Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power, published by Crown. We'll continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Kevin Perano. His book, Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. So Lincoln had a lot of stuff that he was dealing with this on top of the Civil War. You mentioned a crisis with Spain, which led Seward to make some kind of a power play
right.
At one point. The French in Mexico.
Right.
And then worries that some European powers would help the Confederacy. How serious was that a threat?
It was a threat at various times, and at other times it wasn't. But one of the ironies is one of the moments where European powers came the closest to intervening was right after Lincoln had issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln saw this as a tool of foreign affairs, as we were talking about before, and he was partly right about that. In the long term, it helped.
It played well in Europe?
It did eventually, and among ordinary Europeans, there were huge monster meetings that that erupted in Europe in the kind of the early days of 1863 after the Emancipation Proclamation. In the short term, it almost sparked intervention on behalf of the British because they feared the disorder of slave revolts. They had lived through the Indian revolts in 1857, and so in the short term, it could have been a problem.
And Europe also wanted cotton, and that's where the South comes in.
Exactly.
So were they trading? Continued to trade with the South?
Well, there was a blockade. Lincoln, in the early days of the war, instituted a blockade of the southern coast, and so.
Did he invent the war powers concept?
He did in some ways. I mean, there's a we could talk for hours about that issue. But in some ways, he did. He made some important innovations in presidential war powers that. You know, have lasted, have been enduring.
Including that blockade of southern harbors. How did the European nations see that? Did they see that as legitimate?
No, they didn't see it as legitimate. And it might not have been legitimate, frankly, because when he declared this blockade, he's essentially recognizing the Confederacy. So it was a kind of a questionable thing to do in international law, but it was what he needed to do at the time.
And especially since the North was losing battles with the South at that point, which made it look like the North was a losing cause.
Right.
Which might have also tempted the Europeans to become a little friendlier to the South.
Exactly. I mean, Lincoln knew, as Seward did, that battlefield victories would be the most impressive, the best weapon for keeping the European powers out of the war if they thought the U.S. Was winning.
What was the mission assigned to Captain Charles Wilkes, and what brought him to southern Cuba?
Well, Wilkes was a Navy captain. He was kind of a loose cannon. He's a great character, and he would often go off on adventures. And he went to Cuba to try to intercept a couple of Confederate diplomats that were on their way to Europe. And he did. And in fact, he took them off the ship, which is a British mail packet, the Trent. And the Confederate diplomats were put in a Union prison, and the ship was sent on its way. And this created probably the most dangerous diplomatic crisis of the war between the United States and Britain, because it was a British ship. The British said, "This is an outrage. You can't do this." And Lincoln ended up releasing the two diplomats, and in order to avert war, he essentially backed down.
Well, Wilkes had done this against orders, and now Lincoln had to deal with it. But did the British agree to stay out of the war after Mason and Slidell were released?
No, they didn't. I mean, they never agreed to stay out of the war. There was always the risk that one of these flaps would erupt into war. The flap that we were just talking about over the Emancipation Proclamation was much later. So this was a risk that lasted the course of the war from both Britain and France.
Well, had Wilkes fired on the ship?
He fired shots across the bow to stop the ship. So that wasn't really the issue. But the issue actually in international law was that he let the ship go on its way. If he had taken the diplomats with the ship, he would have been in a much better position as far as international law is concerned. But he took the diplomats off the ship, sent the ship on its way, and it created this crisis that Lincoln had to defuse.
You say Karl Marx had an influence on Lincoln. He had a column in the New York Tribune. Did Lincoln read it?
No, he probably did, actually. Lincoln was a religious reader of the Tribune, and Marx wrote 300 or 400 articles. But my point is not that Lincoln really had, or that Marx had an influence on Lincoln or vice versa. But what I do is I look at them side by side in one chapter, and I think looking at them side by side tells us something really important, because in the 19th century, as it is now, the nature of power was changing. Hans Morgenthau, the great scholar of international relations, says nations follow their interests defined as power. So when the nature of power is changing, that's a really important thing in international affairs. And what was happening in the mid-19th century, because of some of these innovations in communications, the globalizing world, power itself was becoming less focused, less centralized. Ordinary people were having a greater role in international affairs. Both Marx and Lincoln had to figure out how to deal with this new dynamic, and they both did so in their own ways.
Did Marx write about the Civil War?
He did. He wrote about the Civil War for the Tribune, which had a huge circulation. It was about 200,000 people read it in the United States. He was let go kind of early in the war from the Tribune, but he continued to write about the United States and the Civil War for an Austrian newspaper. We kind of forget that Karl Marx was a journalist as he's writing Capital, and he was in exile in London at the time. And so he was watching the events in the United States very carefully, partly because Marx believed that if the bourgeois union triumphed over the aristocratic South, then that was the first step toward a proletarian revolution. And so he wanted the Lincoln and the Union to win, although he didn't particularly respect Lincoln as a statesman.
Did Lincoln's reelection shore up European support?
It did. I mean, the worst of the dangers were over by Lincoln's election in 1864. There were still little crises, but the worst of the crises,
like the French emperor.
Although the French emperor offered to mediate the war in early 1863. So the most dangerous crisis in terms of the French was before Lincoln's election. But you're right, the French still occupied Mexico City throughout the war, and that remained a risk until Lincoln's death.
Didn't Napoleon use the Civil War as an opportunity to intervene in Mexico?
Yeah, he realized that it would be awfully difficult for Lincoln and his forces to stop him from doing that. So he saw an opportunity. He saw the United States as essentially an expansionist power, thought for geopolitical reasons, putting a French puppet in Mexico would halt American expansion southward.
Didn't Lincoln try to find foreign colonies abroad for emancipated slaves?
He did, and this was one of Lincoln's mistakes. I basically admire Lincoln's handling of international relations, but he made some mistakes, and the colonization issue, I think, is one of them. Lincoln.
Well, we'd earlier had Monroe do something like that.
There's a long history of colonization. Henry Clay favored colonization, but there were members of Lincoln's own administration, particularly Seward, who told him so at the time. So Seward liked to say, "I'm always in favor of bringing men into this country, never for sending them out." So on that issue, Seward was right. In retrospect, we see that Lincoln was wrong.
Although Seward was wrong on the Emancipation Proclamation, he had opposed it initially.
He had opposed it, and he actually got Lincoln to delay the timing of issuing it. Lincoln had first kind of raised this subject with his cabinet in the summer of 1862, and Seward said, the timing is not right. Let's wait for a battlefield victory first, or it's just going to be a paper proclamation.
In the end, did Lincoln change the way the United States engaged in foreign diplomacy?
I think he did. What I think is interesting is we think of Lincoln as this sort of what one diplomatic historian has called the quintessentially American practical idealist. He was very good at reconciling his realism with his idealism, and he had both in spades. I mean, he said the central idea of this war is to prove that popular government is not an absurdity. So he had a very strong vision of American ideals in the world. On the other hand, he also had his presidency helped to touch off a long period of American expansion. So this tension is what I think is interesting in his legacy.
Kevin Perino, Perraino. His book, Lincoln and the World, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. It is published by Crown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Leonard.